I want you to think back to the summer of 1987. That's going to be tricky for some of you. For some of you were pre-fetus at that point. However, the summer of 1987, it was an amazing time in my life. I was heading to the Usher Hall with Diane, who was my girlfriend of about 6 months at that point. Although I dated her with the purpose of marrying her. And we'd figured by then, well, long figured that that was it. We were working towards marriage. And this was the first time we'd ever been to a Christian conference. And I went into the Usher Hall, of all places, the enormous Usher Hall, with 3,000 other people. I was a brand spanking new Christian. And this was the guy that got up to speak. And he stood up on the platform and he said this. He said, guys, faith is spelled R-I-S-K. And I was hooked. I was absolutely hooked. Just for a bit of history, this guy, John Wimber, used to be a Vegas musician. He was keyboard player for the Righteous Brothers. So if you've lost that loving feeling every now and then. So he stood up there and said, faith is spelled R-I-S-K. He became a Christian. His story is absolutely fascinating. A Bible seller came through Vegas and sold him a King James Bible. And he said, I was so unchurched. I had so little idea. But God worked through John in the most extraordinary way. John's impacted us in two ways. The first way is that John was part of a whole new move of new music. Indeed, for that conference, there was a book of 50, 51 songs, all of which were brand spanking new, had been written by people of part of the movement that he started called the Vineyard Movement. And still to this day, we sing songs that come out of the Vineyard Movement. Any this morning? What beautiful name, certainly, out of the Vineyard Stable, isn't it? So there's an enormous influence that they've had in terms of worship, and they had a full band up the front. John was playing his keyboard. But also, it was John Wimber who used to stop off when he was going to see his friend David Watson in York to take conferences on praying for folks who are sick. He needed a London stopover to fly out to Heathrow, and so would speak at a church in Knightsbridge called Holy Trinity Brompton. And it was at that church that John Wimber's influence started to leach into the Church of England in London. And, well, he wasn't even a curate at this point, but that had a profound effect on Nicky Gumbel and on his boss, Sandy Miller. And so that's where the Alpha Course started. John's one of these figures that, for me, he's kind of like a Wesley. He's one of those people who has had a profound influence over all of our lives, in ways that we barely understand. So he gets up there. He was so funny. He'd have you laughing at one point, and then he'd have you kind of pinned to the wall with a challenge. Warning. So faith is spelled R-I-S-K. And that's how a music producer from Vegas ends up speaking to a whole bunch of European Christians in the Usher Hall in 1987 about trusting in the power of the Holy Spirit, and a stepping into the sorts of things that Jesus did, but which the church had stopped doing in the West. In the book of Hebrews, the writer to the letter of the Hebrews builds up to this amazing point. Hebrews 11, open it up in your Bibles. I'm afraid I don't have a page reference. You're going to need it in a moment, but I've got the first three verses up there. Read them with me if you want to. Faith shows the reality of what we hope for. It is the evidence of things we cannot see. Through their faith, the people in days of old earned a good reputation. And by faith, we understand that the entire universe was formed at God's command, that what we now see did not come from anything that can be seen. So faith is, according to the writer to the letter of Hebrews, it's the reality of the things that we hope for. Get that? Reality of things that we hope for. And the evidence of stuff that we can't see, that's invisible. You with me? Sometimes people say faith's irrational. I think that's ridiculous. I looked at the changes in the lives of the people round about me, and I could see Jesus in them. There were very practical and realistic evidence-based options ahead of me, and I was amazed at the difference in character and the difference in the people I met who were Christians had something in common. There was evidence of the handiwork of someone at work in their lives. But it is the reality of that which we hope for and the evidence of things that we can't see. Yeah? Sometimes when I'm in a meeting with people I think are a bit nervous that I'm a Christian, I'll say, you know, of course I lead a creepy cult in Gore Bridge. And I talk to a dead guy a lot. And they just... Because I realize that from their perspective, I'm absurd. What they think, though, most often is that I don't realize how absurd that looks. Until I start the conversation and I get this looks absurd to you. You know, it looked absurd to me at some point in my life. But the truth is that faith is not a blind trust in some, you know... So many people will say, oh, you're a Christian. You believe in made-up fairy stories. You know? That's the internet trolling one, isn't it? Made-up fairy stories. And first of all, I think that denies the power of fairy stories, I might add. Okay? Fairy stories are parables of their own. But the thing is it's based on much more than that. Much, much more than that. Because at root, faith is not about belief. Now, faith includes belief, but it's not really about belief. It's about taking risky action. A step of faith might start in a discussion in your head about what you believe, but ultimately you're going to have to do something that makes a difference. Do something that makes a change. Do something to carry yourself forward. Faith is made up of risky action. Now, I want you to have a look at your chapter there, Hebrews 11. And just have a look at the list of people that the writer to the Hebrews lists as folks who had that sense, they acted in faith throughout the ages. They had an apprehension of the reality of the things that they hoped for and evidence of things they couldn't see. Call out some names that stick out to you. Abel. Oh, yeah, right at the start. Abel. Enoch, yes. Enoch, who you know, one of these guys who's just kind of disappeared into heaven kind of guy. Brilliant. Noah, yes. Who had a second Eden experience with the animals on the ark, and then things go a bit wrong again in a garden. Just saying, I was listening to that this week. That caught my attention. Yes. Isaac, yes. He who laughs, the unexpected son. Any others? Abraham, oh, the father in faith of us all, yes. Jacob, the twister, the one who grabs the heel. Jacob the swindler, the evidence that God can do amazing things through people with really, really suspect morals and bring them to heel, quite literally in Jacob's case. Sarah, yes, who had to believe. Anyone else? Abel, yes. Esau, well, Jacob, not Esau. There's going to be some interesting contrast in there, yes. So all these people who exercised faith and were people who took risky action in terms of their trust. Let's think about for a moment about, well, Noah was mentioned. Noah was building a boat for a disaster for about 100 years. That's the story. Okay, whatever you think about the historicity of it, the story is that he committed to build an inland boat for a disaster that no one saw coming except him. What about Jacob and Esau? Jacob is challenged by God. He's obviously swindled his uncle Laban, and so now he needs to leave uncle Laban's place and head back, having swindled Esau out of his inheritance, and now he thinks Esau's going to kill him because Esau was a hunter. And he has to humble himself and go back, because to fulfill the promise that God has for him, he needs to humble himself before his brother. Joseph took risky action. Joseph's life ends up in a vice on more than one occasion. And eventually he has to stand in front of the Pharaoh, who has the power of life and death over him, just like his brothers, but this time he's asked for his wisdom. instead of despised for his cockiness. And this time it comes through, and he becomes Pharaoh's second in command. Risky action. There's others. Esther, who stands before the emperor and to plead for her people's lives. And all of these different people are involved in risky action. I was talking to Alistair this week. I love it when this happens, when someone phones up. I think, you might have other plans, but I think God might be saying something about this. And then he reels out the structure of a sermon. Thanks, Alistair. It was really helpful this week and helped me focus my thoughts. After, as a Kirk session, we'd had a discussion about taking risk, more of which I'll talk about later. But he says he can almost see this motto here. Who dares? Which is the motto of? Which stands for? Special Air Service. Which regiment are they? 22nd, I think it is. 22nd Regiment. Who dares wins. Okay. And it's almost as if the motto of that pinnacle of the special forces, and the SAS take great pride. And so the SAS have this motto, who dares? And that could be the motto of every single one of these guys, of Noah and Moses. You think of Moses standing in the presence of Pharaoh with his stick and his stutter, pleading for the release of the slaves who are his brethren. Having grown up in the palace, knowing the Pharaoh, having left all of that behind. I mean, how much courage does that take? Who dares wins. And one of the things that Alistair was sharing as well was about somebody called Brené Brown. Some of you have read Daring Greatly. Brené Brown studies guilt and shame at the University of Houston. There you go. There's a job for you. She's a social scientist, and she studies the effects of guilt and shame. She gave a brilliant TED talk, which then went viral, got all these views, and of course, like anything that gets widely viewed on the internet, people started sniping at her. And she had what she described as a vulnerability hangover, where for a few months, she would barely leave the house, watch Downton Abbey, and eat ice cream. But that thing about daring greatly, acting in faith, standing on the reality of the things that we hope for in Jesus, and living in the evidence of the things that we cannot see, that is to be vulnerable. Now, hands up here if you're a big fan of being vulnerable. Okay. We don't like being vulnerable. And sometimes we protect ourselves. And as I've said, we're rarely our best selves when we're protecting ourselves. It's necessary sometimes. But the truth of the matter is that being vulnerable takes a decision, does it not? The choice to be vulnerable. The choice to trust that this person might be a person of significance in your life as a friend or as a future potential spouse or as someone to take care of. That the risk of stepping into a position in the community or in business, of taking a risk with the resources that you've been given. These things involve a measure of vulnerability, and it can be really uncomfortable. Well, here's the thing. We've been called to a life of risk-taking. Let's have a look at what Jesus said again. Let's read it together again. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure that a man discovered hidden in a field. In his excitement, he hid it again and sold everything he owned to get enough money to buy the field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant on the lookout for choice pearls. And when he discovered a pearl of great value, he sold everything he owned and bought it. So this reading here is one of Jesus' parables. It's in Matthew 13, it's full of parables. Jesus teaching these pithy little stories where he's trying to teach the crowds that are gathered in front of him, his disciples as well. What is it like when God's way of doing things wins out? When the world becomes more like Eden, or in terms of the New Testament, like the New Jerusalem? What happens when the wonder that is the temple in Jerusalem, which is a model Eden on earth, is opened out to the entirety of humanity? And he's trying to teach these Jewish people who are in front of him, this is what it is like. And he uses one example, which is the unexpected find, and another example, which is the expected find. Along with many of Jesus' parables, he makes this kind of distinction. And though he doesn't say it explicitly, you get the sense that the first person is like a Gentile who wasn't expecting to discover this extraordinary truth, that the meaning of life is found in the witness of the Jewish people, and particularly in Jesus. And then you've got the Jewish people who, of course, they're looking for the Messiah. They're busy hunting. They're clued in to picking, you know, wonderful things. And here in their midst is the pearl of great price. And, of course, the pearl of great price is Jesus and the rule of the kingdom that he brings them. Okay? So there's almost a Jew-Gentile thing going on here. But there is that for us as well. You think about, for many of us, some of us were brought up in church. Yeah? We were brought up in church. We never knew any different. But there came that moment for ourselves where we accepted Jesus for ourselves, and there was that joy of doing so, or we kind of drifted in. We maybe don't know when. And that's kind of like the pearl merchant. And the first one is kind of like those of us who are ambling along in our lives, and we were not expecting to be getting mugged by Jesus, especially as some of us were atheists. So, both of these stories, though, talk about a reordering of priorities, don't they? This is a big, big, big decision. Time for a story. Keziah's just bought a new car, needed some warranty work on it. So we went down to Seafield, where you can buy everything, from cheap to expensive, all the way along there at Seafield. I took the wrong turn. I went into the BMW Mini place. So we went in there, and right at the back of it, there's this place where they sell investor cars, okay? Pete Vardy's got an investor car place, and there was old 911 Porsches, and there was a DB5 in there, an old Aston Martin. There was a Bristol. And had I been on my own, I'd have just parked up my car, and I'd have gone in and had a chat with a suity guy and just had a look around what was there, and you think, oh, pearl of great price now. And guys, have you ever done this? Have you ever done this? You ever thought, right, okay, how much for a DB5 these days? 250 grand. Yeah. So if I sold my children and if I sold everything I own and I could borrow this much, I could actually afford one of those. Hey, 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 hey. But I'm not gonna do it. You ever done that? Jesus is saying, if you've ever thought like that, you discover what's coming into this world through me. Forget that. Do it. Do it. Nothing you own is more valuable than what's in here. Reorder your priorities immediately. So, let me ask you a question. Are there any hedged bets in the kingdom of heaven? No? I haven't used this illustration for a while. You'd always end the party on the hokey-cokey, didn't you? All right? And forget a party bag. If you got a bit of birthday cake wrapped up in a napkin, that was, you were off to the races, all right? Didn't get a watch and, you know, whatever else. So the hokey-cokey kind of starts easy, doesn't it? What do we start with? Left leg? Right leg. Where do you end up? Whole self, yeah? Okay, kingdom of heaven, whole self. In truth, how do we live our Christian life? Okay, you got the point. There's no hedged bets in the kingdom of heaven. As soon as we start to hedge our bets, as soon as we start to say, well, I'm 50, 60, 70, 80% sure about this, bad things start to happen. Jesus told another parable about someone who puts their hand to the plow. This is one of the toughest ones. He says, anyone who sets their hand to the plow but looks over their shoulder is not worthy to serve in the kingdom of God. Ouch! Now, just for confession, I've hedged my bets. All right? I've hedged my bets. I've lived kind of practical atheist. Done that now and then. I've set my priorities a bit skew. I'm telling you, I have. I have. And I know you have too. But we are called to live a life of risk-taking. And if we're vulnerable and do that, then we learn a dependence on our Father in heaven that is good for our soul. It's really good for us. We are so brought up to stand on our own two feet in the West, aren't we? But that's not good for us. It's just not good for us. And here's why. Because we are created to live interdependently with our Father in heaven. If your life as you have built it does not depend on God's grace, if there are not moments in your week or your month or your year where you aren't at that place where you're saying, Father, if you do not come through, we're in big trouble, then you are living independently of His grace. And here, by the way, here's one of the big fat lies. Some of us live, I just want to get to that point where I'm wealthy enough or secure enough or confident enough or skilled enough where I can look back on those times where I had to be dependent on God and go, oh, that was really good for me. But now I'm comfortable. Oh, dear. Did Jesus tell a parable about that? Yeah, He told a parable about a farmer who had 6 barns full of grain. And what happens to him? Yeah, he kicks the bucket. He does, and those silos of grain are of no use to him whatsoever. So even we play tricks with ourselves sometimes. Sometimes we just live, we're living towards that point where we're going, great, I don't have to depend on God anymore. No. If you have plans to become a person of much resource, then you're going to have plans of how you're going to give it away. You with me? Not all of it. But to whom much is given, said Jesus' brother James, much is expected. Absolutely. And that might be in power or influence. It might be in leadership. Because to step forward into a place of responsibility in the kingdom of heaven is to learn how to serve. Yeah? Whoever is going to be first among you must become like the least. You see Jesus' worldview and there were people who were wealthy in resources, some of them women, who were part of His inner circle. There's nothing wrong with that, but what are you going to do with it? Right. Now, I want to go back to this idea that faith is spelled R-S-K. Who was here for the Big Win Sunday a few weeks ago? Okay, keep your hand up if it was inspiring. Big Win Sunday, just this extraordinary sense of thanksgiving. Look at what is happening. Let me ask you a question. 10 years ago, could we have done a Big Wins like that? No. Right. Okay. But if you look at the Big Wins for last year, is there room for improvement? Could we grow? Could we reach more people? Could the influence that God has given us expand? In other words, Big Wins in 10 years' time, would we be hoping that it was substantially more wow than this year? Yeah, me too. Because don't get jaded. It's not Christ-like to be jaded, to get stuck in a rut, to use Elspeth's favorite phrase. The truth is that we are always on the cusp of the next thing that God is doing in our midst. But sometimes the expended energy of being involved in the last one has worn us out a bit, and we need to take a bit of Sabbath time, trust in His goodness, and then realize that faith is spelled R-I-S-K, and head out into the new phase of life. Yes? Part of the reason we do Big Wins, so there's a point in the year where we stop and we go, thank you, and we get ready for the next. Right. So challenge time. You up for a challenge? Faith is spelled R-I-S-K. The church here is led by the Kirk Session, okay? I know you probably all think it's me, but it's not. I'm part of the Kirk Session but can't vote, though I do chair the meeting. And the Kirk Session is given the job of leading here. The Kirk Session is made up of elders. Those elders were picked by elders. The fascinating thing is that the elders that serve here are part of a line that goes all the way back to the Scottish Reformation and before that into all sorts of other structures that existed before the Reformation took place in 1560. It's a remarkable group of people. The Kirk Session meets in Kirk Session about seven times a year, and we had our first meeting of the year on Tuesday there. And as we gave thanks for everything that had happened in the past, and we were thinking about heading forward into the future, giving thanks for God's faithfulness to us, we also were looking at the annual report. We produce an annual report. We have to produce an annual report to comply with charities regulation, and also it's a good, honest thing to do. That report deals with the finances of the church. And Ian and his team work away at this, Ian particularly. And when you see this report, my goodness me, one of the key ministries in this church is making sure that business side of things is done. It enables the other ministries to happen. And Ian, we are so thankful. Thank you very much to you and your team. So we now, because the various activities we do, the income of the church have got to a point where we have to do the full Monty church accounts, and it contains all kinds of information, and it looks at things like giving, and it looks at the resources in and out for the church, right? We managed to do an extraordinary amount with not a huge amount of resource. One of the things, and this blew me away, see those elders between them? We bring in about, what was the giving last year? About 100,000? And the elders, the families they represent, gave 36,000 in 2018. I mean, hello? Just between them. Now I know some of you are thinking that there's swanky jobs in there, but there's not that set of swanky jobs, and some of the people in there do very humble things too. Isn't that amazing? This small band of people, there are a dozen elders. Now, obviously, they represent a bigger family group. But between them, they shouldered up over a third of the giving. So well done, elders. Well done. And we were looking, we had a discussion about the risks that face us, and you know, where should we be taking more risk, and where should we be taking less risk. And Alistair said something that really resonated with me. He said, we've seen the most growth when we've taken the most risk. Yeah? Major growth has been built on substantial risk here at Gorebridge Parish. And we say that honestly because part of our task as trustees is that we don't push the risk thing too far. It's our job to try and keep things on an even keel. But we believe that God is calling us to do things that we weren't doing before. Working in the schools, helping out with a food bank, making sure that we've got resources available for young people's work, for getting out into the wider community, for taking on staff that we can build teams of volunteers around, which multiplies our effort. Every time we take on a staff member, there's a kind of multiplication because they can do things that engage key volunteers. So we see the most growth when we take the most risk. And yet there's obviously a point where we're taking too much risk, and it's not faith anymore, it's presumption. And it's the elders' job to try and figure out where that is. So one of the challenges we had last year is that, you want to hear how good God is? We had a bit of a shortfall, we did. We would have ended the year with a deficit, but for a lady who lived in Bonnyrigg and left us a bit of her house. So what do we end the year with, Ian? Surplus of about 200 quid. 200 quid in a six-figure budget, okay? Had that legacy not come in, it was about 13,000, was it? Then we'd have had a hole to fill. And we can look around and say, well, that's not going to happen next year. Maybe it will. But what we need to do is to shoulder that up in giving. So I asked the Kirk Session, because they said, well, I'm going to be preaching on giving on Sunday. What am I asking for? What am I asking for? And it was kind of like, well, I said, $1,000 a month? And I said, at least. So, here's the challenge. What I would like us to do is to pray what we can do. And by the way, not grudging, not what you can't afford, but I know there's folks out there who have been thinking, I need to do this, I need to do this, I need to do this. And maybe Ian will give a word or something. You go, I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it, I'm going to. And then it's kind of like, I get home and it's kind of like, well, just kind of diddy, sneak away. How do I know that? Ask me. Just ask me. So, what I'm going to do today is open up the opportunity for you guys to pledge. And what we're asking for is somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 more a month. This will enable us to build up an operational buffer of about 1 or 2 months to make sure that we can underwrite the work that we're currently doing. And it will enable us to sustain that. Okay? And some of you are going, I don't have a grand a month. I know. We do this by faith. What is faith? It's the reality of what's hoped for, and it's the evidence of the stuff we can't see. What I'm asking of each of you is, we're going to go into a time of prayer, is to prayerfully consider what you might be able to do so that the goodness that God is working through here expands out. Now, first of all, it might be that you don't have any extra resource to give us, and that's fine. It doesn't mean you can't pray. It doesn't mean you can't step out in faith. But we believe, as a Kirk session, that there is extra capacity out there. And by the way, what we're looking for is your faith. Are you with me? The thing that I learned about giving when God first challenged me through my wife to give appropriately, biblically, was that it healed something in me. It healed something in me. And that broken bit was to do with... Anyone here seen Finding Nemo? Okay, Finding Nemo. Lost fish, okay. Well, it's almost a parable. And then in there are some seagulls. What do the seagulls say? Mine. 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 If you say mine like that, enough of you say it. You just sell it. And I had that. I had that as a student minister on a 12 grand salary stipend thing. And I had less of that when I was a skint student than I did when I got my first paycheck in, because now I was master and commander of my own destiny. I didn't have to trust anymore. And so Dan said, what are we going to give? I said, well, 12 grand, 50 quid, right? And she went, well, hang fire. Since when was 50 quid 10% of what's coming in? I went, we can't afford that. I couldn't believe myself. I was so... Yes, we can. 90% in the kingdom is worth more than 100% in the world. And my inner Scrooge was just... Okay? See, when I sorted that, a little angel came down from heaven and took my inner Scrooge round the back of the house and clubbed him to death with his wallet. All right? Because if you have an inner Scrooge, you don't want to hold on to him. He's a mean old miserly, friendless, rubbish-making, nonsense maker. And the quicker he's put to death, the better. Now, does that mean you have to get what? I don't know. You ask God. There's biblical promises around 10%. But even if you start looking at 1% or 2%, giving proportionately, it gets you out of the headspace of donating to a worthy charity to giving as part of your worship, as part of your life. And I'm telling you, I've seen some tight months. We have a lot of mouths to feed, and I have a missus who does extraordinary things sometimes, okay? It can be tight, but this I'll tell you, I never ever look at what goes out to this place and the other charities I support as money that I have access to. I don't even really see it as mine. I just see it as part of my worship, and it's tidied up my heart knowing there's other things I struggle with, but my goodness me, and I would want that for any Christian, because it's not about money, it's about faith. God has given us faith in order to do things. And in some ways, money's the least important resource, but my goodness me, as a nation, it's one of the things that we can do that can have such an impact. So that's my challenge. I'm asking you to step out in faith. And like I say, no pressure, no guilt, don't want a single penny of anybody's resources that is given unwillingly. But I will say this. If you decide to take a risk and it works out that that was a step too far, we will give it back. Do you hear me? We are so serious about this being about a joyful response to God's goodness that if you take a step of faith and you find out 3 months down the line it's not working out, you can have it back. Isn't that right, Ian? We have done it before. Why do I tell you that? Because it's not about the resources. It's about our hearts. Okay. So, for some of you, it will be an amount. Okay? It will be an amount. For some of you, it will be a proportion. And for others of you, it will be a consideration whether you might think about increasing. I get that. But like I say, I don't want anybody to be cross with me. I really don't. I'm a sensitive soul. But what I want is for you to step out in faith and experience that thing that God has to give you. Because the truth is that the kingdom of heaven is always like a pearl of great price. Get the folks who serve at Christmas Day. Okay, Karen and the team. I've never heard them say, I so resent giving up the middle of my Christmas day. They say things like, it's such a privilege to serve these people. You know, it's wonderful. The volunteers at the food bank, it's, you know, I see Val or I see Ellen, and there's never that sense of, oh, I can't believe I've got to do this morning. They step up and serve. Every time I get a coffee at the Community Recycling Project, it's from someone. That's one of the things I love about this church is people don't give grudgingly. They give freely. And it helps our hearts. So, we had a look at Hebrews, didn't we? And all those people in faith. But of course, the writer to the letter of Hebrews is building up to someone. Because who's the person who really showed us how to have faith? Let's read this together. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a huge crowd of witnesses to the life of faith, let us strip off every weight that slows us down, especially the sin that so easily trips us up, and let us run with endurance the race God has set before us. We do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus, the champion who initiates and perfects our faith. Because of the joy awaiting him, he endured the cross, disregarding its shame. Now he is seated in the place of honor beside God's throne. Whenever we take a step of faith in whatever realm, Jesus has been there before us and he's with us through it. Amen? Wonderful. Friends, faith is spelt R-I-S-K.